From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Today we spend the hour with the stars of two TV shows with major cult followings. One centers on a foul-mouthed demon hunter and the other on the world's deadliest spy.
I need to access my operations account, and you're preventing that. Now we can do this easy, or we can do it hard. Your call. No? Hard it is, then.
That's ahead this hour, but first, we talked about how political disagreements can become irreconcilable differences. Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Patricia Carter from Athens, Georgia. I come from a huge family, and what I would say is the singular difference in my friends and family is that it's people who watch Fox and people who don't. Fox issues have made people not only one-sided, but even mean.
We always want to know what you think. You can call us like Patricia did at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We might feature your comment on the show. The Starz original series Ash vs. Evil Dead nears the end of its third season this month. The TV show centers on Ash Williams. He goes after demons. In 1981, actor Bruce Campbell starred for the first time as Ash Williams in the film The Evil Dead. Stephen King famously loved the film, so did millions more. It spawned two sequels, video games, Marvel comic books, and the television series that we were just talking about. I talked to Bruce last year as he prepared to come to Atlanta for Walker Stalker Con. He says that the TV series gives him the chance to make adjustments to his title character.
It's my chance to fix Ash. Be like George Lucas. I'm going to go in and I'm going to fix Ash. Because it's been 25 years since I played the idiot last. So I want to bring actual experience to playing him now. So I'm fixing Ash currently. He's almost fixed.
And that worked so well for George Lucas.
Oh boy, did it.
So this is to let people know who might have never heard of this. Evil Dead was this sort of B-movie, crazy, off-the-wall, just crazy pants horror film that you made with your high school buddy, Sam Raimi, who's since gone on to be a big-time director, directed all the Spider-Man films of the 2000s. And you guys were buddies from high school outside of Detroit. As you look back at those films, Bruce, I wonder, what do you think their appeal was? I think the context in 1981 was very different. Now, 2017, there's all kinds of weird culture everywhere. Back in 1981, there was kind of this mass monoculture that was so dominant, and everything about Evil Dead screamed, we're not part of that. Is that what people liked about these movies?
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe it's just, well, it's blue-collar entertainment, really. Evil Dead actually, you know, viewed in drive-ins when it first came out. So it was a drive-in movie. It was known as a drive-in movie. Yeah. And we actually felt obliged to make it a good drive-in movie because we would study the movies that were out, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Revenge of the Cheerleaders. And if there was a part in these movies that was lousy, the actual viewers would turn their car headlights on and honk their horn until it stopped being lousy. And we went, oh my God, this is our audience right here. These are instant critics. So we thought, okay, if we're going to do a horror movie, it can't ever stop. Once the horror starts, it can't stop. So I credit these lousy drive-ins with really teaching us a discipline. If you're going to go for it, go for it. Don't waste their time.
But what about the sort of... it's not just that it's horror. It's not just that there's violence that interests people. It's that it's hokey. It's intentionally hokey. What did that hokiness mean? What did it signify?
Well, now, bear in mind the evolution of the Evil Dead movies. The first Evil Dead really is what I call kind of a failed melodrama.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of winking at the camera. It was inexperienced actors mostly saying crappy dialogue. And then when the horror starts, it's really over the top because Sam Raimi's a very in-your-face, over-the-top guy. And so crazy ways that monsters were hurting us, you know, I think that sort of put it over the top as well. But then Evil Dead 2 morphed more into what I call splatstick. It was horror and a little more knowing comedy. We also had a little more experience under our belt. And then by Army of Darkness, that really is just like a Ray Harryhausen with, you know, with jokes being cracked. It's like Bob Hope going back to 1300. So, you know, it was a weird evolution of these movies, but it never really started as any one thing. The first Evil Dead is actually meant to be serious, believe it or not. I know it sounds weird. What I like about the current incarnation, it's a guy who is well past his prime. You know, he's a middle-aged, out-of-shape guy who's lazy and has horrible bad habits, and now he's got to save the world. That's the guy that I want to play. I don't want to play the perfect guy in tights. This is actually a great, great... It's become, in my opinion, yeah, put ash in my tombstone now. Now I'm ready for it because I feel like I finally have serviced the character in a way that we want to. Because he is the everyman, which is why he appeals to, you know, a small but fervent audience, that they go, that's me.
You say that Hollywood has lost its middle class of films. There's only movies made with ginormous $400 million budgets or teeny tiny little budgets. I'm wondering if maybe TV has become the new middle class and you've continued to do TV.
Yes,
let's actually
you're
listen to a little
right.
clip of you on Burn Notice. You play a character, Sam Axe, on Burn Notice, great USA series. That series actually included a standalone television film that centered on your character. Let's listen to a scene from that.
You stay here, you die. You come with me.
We live?
Well, the odds are a little better. So look, let's do this. Get the patients outside, load them in the trucks, and let me know if you see any bad guys.
I can't believe you're doing this.
What about me?
You and me are going to build a bomb.
So Burn Notice, prestige TV or slightly sub-prestige TV, that's the new middle class of Hollywood?
Well, it's also B television.
Yeah.
So it fit in perfect. Bad guys,
sure,
briefcases, sunglasses, pretty women, crap blowing up. That's a total B-movie show. You know, so and it was on cable. It was perfect. So that was a great place to be for 7 years. That was really a blast to work on because I didn't have to carry the show. I was Mr. Salt and Pepper, you know?
Yeah. This kind of stuff, B-movie stuff, horror, fantasy, is this what you like, Bruce Campbell, or is it just, are you just blooming where you were planted?
Yeah, well, you fight with the army you got. Yeah, I think it's a little bit of that. I didn't read Spider-Man comics. Sam Raimi actually did. I read Sad Sack. It was about some loser guy in the army. I was more of an Archie comics kind of guy. I never really played the Silver Surfer, Wolverine, any of that stuff. Didn't really play that game. And horror we really got into because it was one of the staples. You could use nobodies. You could have low-budget cars and locations. You didn't need anything fancy. We had done mostly comedies in all of our little amateur movies, but we thought, we'd have to get Steve Martin or somebody. It would be too expensive. So, you know, if you think about it, the early classic low-budget horror movies had nobody in them. Nobody, mm-hmm. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Halloween was Jamie Lee Curtis, but nobody knew who she was. So it was a great way to break in. And then we've since sort of try to retroactively shove our humor into stuff. So I'm always attracted to things that are a little more pronounced, like Hercules and Xena. My representatives never knew why I was going down there to work on those silly cable syndicated shows. I'm like, because we have a great time and we can get away with murder on that show. I'm an actor. Shut up. This is what I do. You know, so I seek roles and stories that I think are a little loopier, a little more not mainstream in a way. So I'm akin with the sci-fi fantasy horror folks, only in that I don't really like mainstream stuff as much.
A lot of the attention you get is going to conventions, and that's been going back years. John Hodgman writes in the foreword to your book that one of the ways he was able to get attention from a publisher was by showing them a video of you showing up at a con and kids going crazy for you. Like, proof. Look, it's not mainstream, but there's lots of people out here that want this stuff. And in fact, the reason you're coming to Atlanta is to go to a con, Walker Stalker Con.
Walker Stalker should be huge, by the way, so watch out.
Cons used to be necessary because people had no other access to the people who were into this kind of stuff had no other access to each other, right? Now with the internet,
it was twofold in that, you know, when I was a kid, there was no way to see Shatner. Now the guy's in 52 cities a year. You know, he's amazing. And then conventions started with guys who were from TV shows that were 30 years old. Now there are a much better blend of shows that are actually on the air right now, like Norman Reedus from Walking Dead, guys like that, and Michael Rooker from, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, all the way back to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. That's when he first came to the cons, because they knew him as that guy. Yeah. Now he's even more popular than before because of, you know, he got in a mainstream movie. So it's great. The green rooms of these conventions are awesome. You know, Elvira making green tea, Stanley's napping in the corner, Shatner's tweeting his brains out. You know, it's really a fun, and I love meeting these people too. It's just, I get to approach them now. That's the one difference. It's like, shut up, it's a green room. It's like Switzerland. Yeah. Someone comes up, goes, hi, Mr. Chatter, Bruce Campbell, how are you? He can't say, you know, screw you, like he, you know, normally.
He's kind of infamous for doing that, even in professional situations.
He's great. No, he's, you know what you do? Is I come up, I kiss his ring, say good morning, Bill, you're looking great, and then I'd never bother him again, and he loves that.
Gotcha.
His conversations are short and sweet. And I didn't hit him with Star Trek when I first met him. Mm. I went T.J. Hooker, and it caught him by surprise. And I actually knew T.J. Hooker, and I commented on how he would do these power slides up to the crime scene. And the camera would keep rolling without a cut, and Shatner would get out. So it was him who did that. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that to him, and he got this startled look on his face of like, nobody's ever mentioned that to me before. So if you meet one of your people that you're dying to meet, you wait 2 hours in line, don't hit him with the obvious. Go throw him a curve.
That's Bruce Campbell, who stars as Ash Williams in Ash vs. Evil Dead. The Starz series winds up its third season later this month. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. All this hour, we're talking about two TV shows with massive cult followings. Before the break, I talked with Bruce Campbell, best known for his role as Ash Williams on the Starz TV series Ash vs. Evil Dead. Another popular show enters its ninth season next week. It's on FXX, and the show is called Archer. Produced in Atlanta, the show revolves around a deadly spy named Sterling Archer. Archer has an obsession with a certain woman.
Lana. Lana.
Lana!
What?
Lana. Lana.
Lana!
What?
Lana. Lana.
Lana!
What?
Lana Kane is the show's lead female character. She and Archer have a love-hate relationship. More often than not, Lana is saving Archer from almost certain doom. Lana is voiced by actress Aisha Tyler, and she spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley.
So, the Lana Kane, the character herself, used to be, it looks like, from the storyline of the show, she started out as an activist and got recruited to be a spy straight from the protest line.
Yeah, I think Mallory Archer saw some kind of a kindred soul that day. For people who haven't seen the episode or who don't know the show, you know, Mallory Archer is Sterling's mother. She runs a spy agency. All spy agencies are clandestine. This is clandestine even from other clandestines. And she meets Lana when she's kind of a, you know, this hyper-intellectual college activist. And she's also an anti-fur protester. And she goes to throw blood on Mallory's fur coat.
Fur coat, yeah.
I might have been red paint. And they have this kind of standoff where, you know, Mallory, who's, you know, killed men for less, threatens Lana, and Lana doesn't blink. And in that moment, they fall in a very specific and moderately platonic kind of love, and Mallory recruits her to become a spy.
Yeah, although
she sees a deadness. She sees a deadness in Lana's eyes that she connects with.
The lack of spark. And yes. I don't know if Lana knew how to fight before she joined, or she was just a really good study, but she is the one that actually is often the most lethal. Take a listen.
Our agents are highly trained in many disciplines.
Like Krav Maga.
My arm! You're breaking my arm!
Lana!
I'm
sorry, did that hurt?
Do you think of Lana as a feminist character?
Oh, 100%. And I think of her as a feminist in the most modern sense of the word, in the sense with the most clarity. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of dogma in any kind of like movement, but I think, you know, Lana is a progressive in some ways. She's, you know, maybe, I mean, in the beginning, I think we talked about her, Adam Reed and I, the creator of the show, as a kind of a closet Republican. So, you know, she has these kind of progressive ideals, but she also is potentially an economic conservative and a social liberal. So she's complex. And I think that is the embodiment of the modern feminist, which is that women are not a monolith. But I think at her best, at kind of her core, she's just a self-determining woman. And she wants what she wants, and she pursues it with vigor and aggression. I mean, everything from being, you know, essentially the only senior spy at this agency other than Mallory, having her eye on the chairwomanship of this organization, being in the field with all the other men, being a better spy than all the other men, and also eventually becoming a single mother on her own, you know, by choice. She's just, you know, she embodies the idea, the feminist idea, that everyone should be the architect of their own destiny and also kick a lot of butt.
She does kick a lot of butt. And she also has almost a perfect foil to sort of express her own individuality and strength in Sterling, who is not quite as progressive. Here's another clip.
Baby crazy?
That's why I dumped her.
You little, what? You suck what? Of I dumped you because you're dragging around a 35-year-old umbilical cord!
See?
So how much of the dialogue is printed? How much do you get to play around with it?
These scripts come to us in perfect, immaculate condition. I mean, there's never a need to embellish because the writing is so brilliant. Sometimes Adam gives us opportunities to improvise. You know, hey, ad-lib something here. But the show, as you see it, springs wholly formed from the brilliant mind of Adam Reed. And I think none of us ever come in thinking we know better than him.
Yeah, although you're doing you're reading your lines not to each other, not to fellow actors.
No.
Yeah. Are you alone in your booth?
Yes. So we're not even all in the same city.
Right.
Chris and Judy and I are on the West Coast, and John and Jessica are in New York. And then Amber and Lucky, who play Pam and Krieger, are in Atlanta. So
Archer is like a footnote on your career right now. I mean, you've got the Criminal Minds thing. You've got you were obviously, a lot of people were first introduced to you through your role on Friends. When I mentioned that in the newsroom, they said, oh, yeah, the smart one. And then
that's nice.
Talk Soup. You have your own talk show. You do a podcast. So what planning software do you use?
Brain, which is clearly malfunctioning right now. I need to update Brain because Brain software not working. You know, I don't have, it's funny, I am kind of obsessed with effectiveness, but I don't use any high-tech software to organize my day. But I will say that I do, you know, I think my life is kind of 90% joyful play and in an area that I'm wildly challenged and engaged by. I love what I do. And then 10% crippling workaholism.
Your reaction, I mean, which at this point has to be getting old, when your credentials as a nerd are questioned. The entry into nerdism and geekism seems to, for some people, be limited.
And reserved for men and reserved and precluded for people of color. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that get old when you go to these cons?
Yeah. I mean, it's tiresome. I don't get outraged by it. You know, I think that when you are an excluded group, you can develop this kind of, I don't know what the actual term for it is, but when a group is hazed and then they return and haze as viciously or even more viciously the group that follows. But I think you have a group of people that's been excluded for most of their lives, and they finally have something that they feel is theirs, and they don't see that they're employing the same kind of exclusive strategies that were used against them when they were growing up. They're not even always aware of it. But it doesn't affect me personally, because it is who I am. It's not a choice that I made. And I had Seth Green on my podcast several years ago, Girl on Guy, and we were talking about kind of taking on the mantle of nerdery. And he said, you can't call yourself a nerd if you didn't spend a significant amount of your childhood playing alone. And so by that litmus test, you know, I should be reserving a cape of some kind or, a crown. Because, I mean, a big part of my childhood was playing in my backyard alone, playing on my playground alone, reading on the bus for hours until I missed my stop and had to be collected from the turnaround lot. I was a very isolated kids socially, and I was a big reader, and I had glasses, and I was the only black kid in my school. I mean, at the time, that, you know, that felt like a pariah state. You know, I was lonely, but it was everything that made me who I am today. So when people challenge it, it doesn't matter to me, because it's like telling me that, you know, I don't know that you know, you're not nearsighted. Well, I am nearsighted, and I wear contact lenses. And no matter how many times you say it, it's not going to undo the fact that I can't see a thing when I get out of bed in the morning, you know. So those challenges, they're meaningless.
So I have to ask you this about Wikipedia, which I always scan before I do an interview. And the reason I scan it is because you often find weird stuff in there, and I don't know how it arrived. So I have to ask you this, because Wikipedia makes it sound like you would never have gone into acting were it not for your crush on Sam Rockwell. Because they say you followed him into an improv class and basically never left.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And who knows if I would have gotten into acting or not. My mother says I was always this kind of presentational ham. I think I was a subtle and thoughtful, tiny intellectual. But, you know, we can dispute that on an ongoing basis. That is a true story. And when I interview people on my podcast and I ask them how they got into acting, I will tell you that 95% of them say it's because of a girl or a boy. I mean, I have a line. I say it. It's always a girl. It's always a girl. Guys are like, there was this cute girl in acting class, and I followed her in there. And the girl and I never dated, but, you know, acting and I fell in love. And it is very true that I went to school with Sam Rockwell. I had a big crush on him. I followed him into an improv class, and I fell in love with the improv class. And I might have found my way there anyway, but that is not apocrypha in any way. And in fact, Sam and I are still very, very close friends to this day. And he makes a little cameo in my first film. So
did you ever date him?
Yes, we did. We dated. Oh, yeah. Oh, look at me. Of course we dated.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking
for no reason other than curiosity. We dated.
Well, see, there you go. You got to get it out of the way. You got to rule it out. So this is probably going to be another weird question I have to ask you, because there's one thing that Lana's really well known for on the show, and it's these long rants. Here's an example.
So
what? Anxious about a half-drunk first-time driving a submarine idiot taking me to the bottom of the ocean to face 40 eco-terrorists led by a crazy person who's about to bomb the entire East Coast with nerve gas?
I was gonna say...
What? What were you gonna say?
So, does it hurt your voice? Do you have to do stuff to protect your voice?
I love how practical of a question that is. It does hurt my voice. And in fact, sometimes we'll save those rants or the screams for the end of the show, because I don't have a delicate voice, but it just is under an additional amount of pressure than most people experience. You know, I work on a talk show where I'm required to talk for a living. And then I do Archer, which requires a lot of talking. And then when I'm doing my podcast, that's 90 minutes typically of conversation. So it just is strained more than most voices. And I have come out of Archer sessions virtually hoarse, like having coming out with kind of laryngitis, no voice at all. So we try to kind of be strategic about how we do those scenes. And I think if you listen back to some episodes of Archer, I can't tell you which ones because I clearly have a terrible memory. There are some where I am barely able to speak and I'm kind of forcing it out, which is fine. I mean, you know, I'm a vocal athlete. I can get through it. But she's a demanding lady, Lana Kane.
And Lana Kane, that demanding lady that Aisha Tyler plays, returns for the 9th season of Archer, which premieres next week on FXX. Aisha Tyler spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley.